Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, on today's Leonard Lopate show, a look back at the New York City financial crisis of 1975, which nearly bankrupted and permanently did transform the city and reshaped our ideas about government across America. Plus, Paula Hawkins, author of the best-selling book, Girl on the Train, on her new novel, Into the Water. That's today at noon on WNYC. Now, despite what many consider the hypersexualized culture we live in today, my next guest says the emotional response that often follows one of our most primal behaviors has severely distorted the public's understanding of the most basic statistics, trends, and behaviors related to sexuality. So joining me now is Ross Benish. He's a reporter at Digiday who has previously worked for Esquire and Deadspin. And in his new book, The Sex Effect, Bearing Our Complicated Relationship with Sex, he looks at how sex indirectly impacts society in many inadvertent ways, and conversely, how non-sexual aspects of society indirectly influence people's sexual behavior. So, Ross Benish, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me on, Brian.
You want to start with one story from the book in particular having to do with the military and LGBTs?
Yeah, absolutely. So, one of the cool things, I guess, about doing all this research was you got to dig into the effects of policy. And what was interesting to me was all these unintended consequences. So people will put in some sort of rule, hoping it will do one thing, but, you know, obviously it goes haywire and it has the exact opposite effect. And one hidden unintended consequence is that many of the policies that were intended to discriminate against gay men in the military have inadvertently advanced LGBT visibility. And just one example would be the Castro neighborhood in San Francisco. A reason it grew so much around World War II is because gay men were discharged in that area and you were publicly outed. And if you're publicly outed during that time, you're not going to go back home. So you stay in the city that you're at and you have this huge gayborhood, which obviously was not the intention of the policy framers.
But what you're saying is that wound up being an economic driver for good in San Francisco that resulted from discrimination by the U.S. military.
Yep, pretty much.
And then there's the Richard Florida theory that kind of flows from that, which is, you know, like if you're a Rust Belt city in the Midwest, make yourself very gay friendly and you'll attract a lot of LGBT professionals to your city.
Well, the thing with Richard Florida's theory, That's part of it, but a lot of it is the indication of tolerance. So you will bring in the LGBT workforce, but that's not going to be like 70% of the population. But if you have a prominent gayborhood, that shows you're tolerant, and young educated workers gravitate toward that sort of thing.
Another unintended consequences story in your book, Viagra and the vibrator, which seem like inherently sexual inventions to us today, not originally intended to impact sexual behavior.
Yeah. So I'll start with Viagra. Viagra was, intended to be this heart medication, and they realize, well, all these test patients want to keep this drug, and then they realize, well, it's because it's giving them long-lasting erections. And then you have a pharma industry that's pretty thirsty using that to essentially influence our perception of sexual dysfunction by having some sponsored research, which is, I think, the most interesting part of Viagra. Yeah, and vibrators, you think of this as this big tool for masturbation, but it has a pretty sexist origin with women being treated for a bogus catch-all disease called hysteria. They had to use a vibrator because, they didn't want anyone to masturbate at home.
My guest is Ross Benish. His new book is The Sex Effect, Bearing Our Complicated Relationship with Sex, which looks at how sex indirectly impacts society in many inadvertent ways, and conversely, how non-sexual aspects of society indirectly influence people's sexual behavior. And if you have any questions for him, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or maybe examples that fit into this framework. And you write, the stigma surrounding sex makes any rational analysis of sexual behavior nearly impossible outside institutional contexts because of the overwhelming amount of bias that many researchers, commentators, and theorists allow to cloud their specifications. And so you cite the percentage of gay people in the world as an example, the divorce rate as an example. So let's take those. How about the divorce rate as an example of that irrationality?
Yeah. So the divorce rate has actually been declining, mostly since no-fault laws first became common. And you will hear so often people who want to sell a theory that the world is going to hell in a handbasket and you need their help for salvation. They will say a divorce rate's 50% and climbing. Well, it hasn't been 50% for quite a while. And when you dig into it, you actually realize the statistics are pretty imperfect. A lot of them come from groups that have a big agenda to push. These aren't like just easily organizable, broad census terms that people are usually citing. So it sticks in our culture. It's something that's easily remembered, but it's actually false, and there's a lot more nuance to it than is usually reported.
And the percentage of gay people in the world?
Well, not so much in the world, but at least in the U.S. Our misperceptions of how common, how many people that are gay in our society can be illustrated by Gallup polls that show that the most common response in those polls, more than 33%, people believe that at least 25% of our population is gay, which would make our population as gay as the band Queen. And the reality is, first off, it's a hard thing to measure because you have many people who aren't out. But the Williams Institute out of UCLA does the best research on this, and they estimate about 3.8%. And they're trying to include people that may not be out. It's obviously imperfect, but this like way beyond 10% thing is a little misrepresentative, and it actually can benefit some of the homophobic policies because people can exaggerate the economic impact of, having to provide benefits for gay marriage.
I could imagine, and maybe you looked into this and you know, that both gay rights advocacy groups and anti-gay rights advocacy groups would have a motivation to exaggerate the percentage of the population that's gay.
Absolutely. You hear 10% cited a lot, which comes from Kinsey, which Kinsey in many ways is as much of an advocate as he is a researcher. But it's also was driven by activists who back in the 60s and 70s were visible to society. So like they need to make people know that they're around. And there wasn't great research at the time. You're just kind of estimating. So they had reason and motivation to say we're about 10% of the population. And then obviously the anti have motivation to, sell this story of doom and say that the world's becoming gay and it's a choice and all these other pseudoscientific things.
Right, exactly. And in the book, you point out that sex's largest impact in our society doesn't come from things the average person would recognize as overtly sexual, but rather its greatest effect can be seen in innocuous, seemingly non-sexual aspects of everyday life. And one example you give was how sex was the impetus for popular foods like graham crackers and cornflakes because of what you say is known as the degeneracy theory. Really?
Yeah. So the way we eat breakfast is indirectly influenced by sexuality because you had these preachers like Sylvester Graham and John Harvey Kellogg who believed that sex was the worst thing in the world, like even between married people. Kellogg didn't consummate his marriage, for example. And the best way to reduce libido was through a bland diet, and to make our diets more consistently bland, they introduced breakfast foods that became modern cereal. Back then, they weren't sugar contaminated, but that was the idea, to stop you from pleasing yourself.
Interesting. There's a major intersection between sex and politics, obviously, which you address in the book. The second chapter of the book is titled All the President's Women, Breaking Down the Predictable Phenomena of Politician Sex Scandals. And in it, you actually write, rather than freak out, people should expect sex affairs from politicians because sexual risk-taking reflects leadership traits that constituents desire. Uh-oh. Really?
Yeah, I that chapter is going to get a little more heat since I wrote that, a few years before Donald Trump had any chance at the presidency. But I do think there is something to that. And what I'll add is it's consensual sex scandals. I think there's a huge difference. There's multiple types. There's, you know, a lot of nuance here. But I think of something like the Lewinsky scandal, and I think that's one of the dumbest scandals in our country's history. We almost kicked out a president out of office for consensual sex with Monica Lewinsky. While that doesn't have any impact on, you know, economics or a military intervention or all these things that actually matter to our lives, but we still act surprised because we have this knee-jerk relationship with sex, even though when you think about it, a politician is a rich, usually good-looking person with a lot of power. Those are all the ingredients that make someone attractive, and they often are risk takers.
But it's one thing to describe them that way and say that they have a lot of opportunity for mm-hmm. extramarital affairs and so forth. But it sounds from that quote like you're going, you know, for a judgment that somehow the affairs reflect leadership traits that constituents find desirable.
They do, because they want bold, risk-taking people. We like big personalities for better or for worse, and you'll see association between those big, bold, risk-taking personalities and the affairs. We
right.
like it
so
when they give
speech. Yeah. So it leave the average person kind of conflicted, like, oh, we like this big, bold, risk-taking personality, but why did you have to do that?
Yeah.
And we'll continue in a minute with Ross Benish, author of The Sex Effect, Bearing Our Complicated Relationship with Sex. And listeners, any questions for him? We'll go through some of the other really interesting examples that he brings up. But you can also ask a question or give us an example from your own observations about his theory here that sex indirectly impacts society in many inadvertent ways, and conversely, non-sexual aspects of society indirectly influence people's sexual behavior. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with journalist Ross Benish. His new book is The Sex Effect, Bearing Our Complicated Relationship with Sex. And you write, conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican, Puritan or free lover, devout or agnostic, it doesn't matter. At some point, every group displays some improbable logical fallacies when differentiating between its perception of sex and the realities of the world we live in. Each group has in some ways blinded itself with its respective ideologies, resulting in unintended sexual and societal consequences. You want to give us an example?
Sure. So I'm trying to be, you know, as moderate as I can in a book about sex. An example, I guess, of a more a liberal thing that has gone off the rails a little bit, I would say the way that AIDS relief is approached at an international level. We always use biomedical and condom-based solutions, even though partner reduction in countries like Zimbabwe and Uganda have actually been shown to be more effective, which, again, isn't abstinence, but it often gets equated to that. But, like, well-intentioned liberals have a very difficult time dealing with that. I noticed that chapter's gotten a lot of flack for that reason. And on a the more like conservative side, well, I think the example we gave with John Harvey Kellogg inventing cereal because he thought masturbation was the end of the world is obviously an irrational response.
Let's take a phone call. Tom in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to just ask him if he could maybe comment on the more positive effects of this. I'm thinking of something more like men buying fast cars or gym memberships or the explosion in plastic surgery, whether it's implants or tummy tucks and things like that. And, you know, how much of a positive impact has it had on our economy?
On our economy.
How much of a positive impact has sex had on our economy?
Have sort of obsession with being sexually attractive?
Yeah, you know, the kind of
diets. Yeah. I think that the sexuality has impacted our economy in a positive way, in that you see pornographers are usually at the cutting edge of adopting new technologies. So our desire for some sort of sexual media leads these entrepreneurs to innovate, and many of the technologies that we use in our everyday lives, particularly ones online like e-commerce and chat rooms, those were driven by sex in a way.
Although if you're going to measure economic effects, I think you have to take the psychosocial effects into account, especially on girls and women, of all these things that they're trying mm-hmm. to be sold to have these perfect images in the eyes of whoever sees these as perfect images. And so I don't think we can ever look at economic impact, even if it's a positive economic impact in and of itself.
Oh, there's a million confounding variables that will make these things skewed one way or the other, depending on which angle you want to take.
Right, when there are so many social downsides. Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I just thought that the theory being propounded with regard to political leadership needs to be reexamined, or at least limited to men, because I suggest that if Hillary had gotten out there and done some of the comparable things, she would simply be considered a slut, and it wouldn't get her any place in the political arena.
I think that's right. There would be a complete double standard between men and women respect, right?
And what's tough about that research, too, is because, like, women have, been discriminated against throughout history, there's fewer women in power. I'm drawing so many historical examples in the chapter where there's like an invisibility thing when you're comparing genders. But I do think there would be a double standard. And as much as we freak out about male politicians, I think it would be even more unfair if a female was in a scandal.
And a few people are calling to push back on the premise that the relationship between Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky was consensual. I'll let Shanti in Kingston, Pennsylvania, voice this for a few people who are calling in. Hi, Shanti.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that while we may have defined that as consensual, I think we need to complicate that by looking at the power differential in that relationship.
Right, obviously. And she was an intern and he was president of the United States.
Exactly. So that in itself is hugely problematic. And then also just raises questions of President Clinton's judgment. I mean, if you can set aside questions of morality and what that means about, his commitment to marriage, but I think just a judgment in making that decision where there's such a massive power differential with him in office.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not trying to back Bill Clinton here. I'm sorry if it was misconstrued that way, but Bill Clinton, he made misjudgment throughout the whole scandal. To have it in the first place, to continue to lie about it, then it continued to become the bigger and bigger and bigger news story. My main point with the Clinton thing was it wasn't for the amount of attention it got, it wasn't something that affected broad like economic or military indicators that really impact people's lives.
And that was, even though people were disgusted by a certain effect that it did have, because if this is out there and the president is doing this with an intern, and you have children who are seeing this, or he sets himself up as a role model in a certain respect and people think this is okay and they can get away with it, or lots of other mm-hmm. negative effects of this being just out in the world the way it was, ultimately the American people came to the conclusion that you're suggesting, which is that they did not back his removal from office because they felt he was doing, quote, a good job.
He had a good economy at the time.
And that had a lot to do with him being back, and that his what was seen as private personal behavior shouldn't mm-hmm. have been forced out into the public eye by the legal process and the Republicans in the first place.
I just noticed in Europe these things don't become the distraction that they are here and used by political opponents. Newt Gingrich was able to attack Clinton even though Newt Gingrich was having his own affairs.
Yes. They called it compartmentalization, I think, in Clinton world. Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And my question is basically, how would you perceive Trump getting elected and having the vote of 53% of women voters?
in light
of
his,
white women voters.
Yeah, of white women voters, exactly. In the light of all that he's done and his sexual exploitation of women, bragging about his wife, you know, saying that he would still love her even if she was mangled in a car crash, you know, as long as her breasts were intact. I mean, multiple affairs, infidelities, you know, and it didn't seem to matter to voters. And he was elected anyway, on top of having zero experience in government. And then we, you know, we've impeached Bill Clinton over his infidelity, but this person, it seems every day in the news, there's a different scandal.
Thank you, Ann. Does it relate to any of these, you know, intersections between sexual things and non-sexual things that is the heart of your book?
The Trump thing, I don't know where to start explaining. I feel like all of us get into these think pieces trying to rationalize this crazy thing that's happened because it shouldn't have happened for, you know, tens of thousands of reasons. I don't see any, like, of the surprising indirect effects with the book relating to Trump so much since I wrote that before I ever knew he would have a chance.
And someday people will be able to figure out the answer to your question, Ann.
Yeah, right, I just don't have a good answer.
So many people scratch their heads. Religion and sex is also a topic in your book. And you're right, although the Catholic Church is often viewed as one of the biggest opponents of gay marriage, the Church's hostility toward married clerics and homosexuality has helped make the Catholic priesthood disproportionately gay compared to the rest of the population. So with such a large gay population, why haven't we seen the Catholic Church take on a more accepting stance toward homosexuality?
Well, the Church, when it develops doctrine, it changes very slowly, if it changes at all. So the demographics of the priesthood, I don't see, you know, pushing this issue a whole lot. But you could also look at some policies that the Church has, in some ways, actually gone, not under Pope Francis, but under Pope Benedict, that actually tried to confront this issue in a more combative way rather than an accepting way, that they tried to ban gay men from seminaries after the sex abuse crisis. And the catechism was rewritten when it was translated from Latin into English. They inserted some language that was more homophobic that had been removed. So I think with the Church, we often try to impose our, like, contemporary American values on them. But even if they see that a lot of their leaders are gay men, I don't think it's going to, like, prompt them to make a rapid adjustment, because that's just not the structure that they operate on.
A lot of cognitive dissonance there.
Absolutely.
Ross Benish is the author of The Sex Effect, Bearing Our Complicated Relationship with Sex, the new book in which he looks at how sex indirectly impacts society in many inadvertent ways, and conversely, how non-sexual aspects of society indirectly influence people's sexual behavior. Thank you for talking about it with us.
Thanks, Brian.